From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Connection this hour was made on November 10th, 1969, when a new children's television show debuted on PBS. If you're like millions of people around the world, you recognize this theme, the theme of Sesame Street. And when a young college student heard it for the first time, it changed her life. Sonia Manzano was a student at Carnegie Mellon University when she saw the show for the first time, and she says she recognized her neighborhood. Manzano was from the South Bronx, and for the first time, she was seeing her stoop, her trash cans, her neighbors on the screen. 2 years later, Manzano auditioned for the show and landed the role of Maria, a character that has since become beloved and iconic for generations of kids. She talked to Cookie Monster about nutrition, she helped Big Bird understand death, and she helped millions of kids learn their ABCs. Manzano brought something special to the role, and her impact on Sesame Street is more than meets the eye. For many viewers, she was the first Latina woman they had ever seen on TV. And over the course of her 44 years on the show, Manzano won 15 Emmy Awards for writing scripts that explored a number of issues, including multiculturalism. While Manzano's face and voice may be familiar, her story may not be. She grew up in a tumultuous home and looked at TV as an escape. As Maria, she brought that same sanctuary to many children like her. Manzano will be a guest of the YWCA of Rochester and Monroe County this Wednesday, speaking at its Empowering Women Luncheon. But first, it is my privilege and honor to have her as a guest on Connections. Sonia, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, sure. My pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, just hearing your voice brings me back to my childhood. I'm sure you hear that all the time.
I do. I didn't realize I had such a distinctive voice until after I was on Sesame Street for several years. And especially now that I'm not on the show anymore, people recognize me by my voice.
Our team behind the glass, Audrey and Rob, are smiling as well. So we're all very excited to have you on the show. Also joining me this hour is Jean Carroll, President and CEO of the YWCA of Rochester and Monroe County. Welcome, Jean.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Jean, you are joining us today, and we should be thanking you for bringing Sonia to Rochester because of this Empowering Women Luncheon. Can you give us a little preview of what we can see on Wednesday?
Well, the Empowering Women Luncheon is a chance for the YWCA to tell the story about our mission, which is eliminating racism and empowering women. When people ask me, what is the YWCA about? I say, well, we're about race, gender, and poverty. And those are three big challenges in our community, especially. So we like to show that no matter where you are, you can someday be Maria or someone like Maria. Her book, Becoming Maria, is just a fantastic story. So we get to have her share her story, but we also get to have some local stories of women here in Rochester who have overcome barriers.
And again, that luncheon is Wednesday, but registration is officially closed.
Yes.
So if you're hoping to hear from Sonia, now's your chance, listeners. And you can call and ask your questions. It's 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, the number's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email your questions to me at connections@WXXI.org. And I'm also on Twitter at MMacMedia. So, Sonia, we'll turn to you now. And again, it's just an honor for me to have you on the show. Your journey to Sesame Street started when you were a very young girl. And what I mean is that you grew up in some circumstances that were tough, and you used that experience on the show, knowing that some kids may understand where you came from, and you wanted to give that gift to them. Tell us about what your childhood was like.
Well, as you said, it was very tumultuous. I lived in a household ruled by domestic violence at a time when that term wasn't used or known. I remember the one social phrase I kept hearing was that children should not come from a broken home. And my siblings and I would snicker at that because we thought that that's exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted to come from a broken home and separate our warring parents, but that was not to be. And so, as you said, I was raised in that kind of environment and found lots of comfort on watching characters on television, the sitcoms of the 50s, Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver. They seemed a sane and chaos-free place for me to go each day.
Mm-hmm. But you weren't really seeing families that looked like yours.
No, it was a sort of a double-edged sword, because though I found comfort in it, I didn't see any people who looked like me on television or in any other media. We were pretty invisible at that time. You didn't see any Latin or African-American teachers, doctors, bus drivers, policemen. And so I did wonder, on some unconscious level that I'm sure children do, I wondered how I was going to contribute to a society that didn't see me, what part I would play in this world that I saw through this television set. It was like a tunnel into the bigger world. And I did wonder where my place would be in it. It was wonderful that I came of age in the late 60s, when America was a changing society.
Did you envision yourself becoming an actor when you were young, or is that something that came later to you?
I could not envision myself being an actor. You know, if someone had suggested that to me when I was a kid, I would have suggested they commit themselves to the nearest insane asylum. It was such a far-fetched idea. My mother would take us to see Mexican movies, and I would see Latin Mexican actors perform in those movies, but I didn't see anyone in the United States performing in any movies or on television. But I did always love theatrics. There was the Million Dollar Movie was a series that we used to watch evenings. They would show the same movie the whole week. And it was wonderful when they would show movies like Top Hat or other musicals. And I would love the musicals, and I would love the fantasies, and I loved the girl singers in the sexy nightclubs in the 1940s movies. So I did have an affinity for performing and fantasy. So that was clear, but I didn't think I was going to have a place in that world. As I said, the 60s opened a lot of things up for many people, and society was idealistic at that time. And after a checkered educational journey, I wanted to go to college, and I did not have the grades, but I was determined to go to college. And I heard about schools that accepted kids on auditions, and I thought, okay, I'll try that. So I took my love of theatrics, and I auditioned for Carnegie Mellon University and got accepted into their dramatics program. But I have to say, man, because I hope that the young kids are listening, it wasn't so much that I wanted to be an actor. It was more that I wanted to go to college, and this was how I was going to get there. I didn't care if I had to major in basket weaving. I was determined to go to get a higher education, or at least get my foot in the door.
Mm-hmm. We just had a conversation during our last hour of this program about a report that's identifying some key issues for kids in our city, and the graduation rate here in Rochester, as of the report last year, is 51%. And we had a caller who called in to say that college should be everyone's job. And our panelists are saying, you know, college is not for everyone. It's a great option for a lot of people. And for you, it seemed to be a way to expand your horizon to, I'm not sure what you meant by checkered educational past, but for you, it seemed to open up a lot of doors, and it eventually led to a career that you had for 44 years.
Right. Let me explain about my checkered educational path. I was an A student in the South Bronx. I would phone it in. I would give myself manicures in my desk and still answer questions and still be an A student. But it was because very little was expected of me. If I just showed up and didn't get into any trouble and I wasn't a felon, I could stay in the smartest class track. They had a tracking system. If you were considered smart, you stayed in this smart groove your whole educational career. But if you weren't, if you didn't speak English or you were disabled, you were put in the low achievers class your whole career. Well, I was in the very smart track. And I was quite shocked then, as you can imagine, when a lovely teacher suggested I audition for the High School of Performing Arts, which was the Fame School. They had a television show about it, and there was a movie about it. And mm-hmm. it's a real school in New York. Now it's called LaGuardia. But at that time, it was the High School of Performing Arts, and this teacher suggested I try for acting. And I got accepted. And my grades went from being an A student in the South Bronx to a C student at the High School of Performing Arts because I couldn't compete with the middle-class educational careers that these kids had. I didn't know how to debate. I thought I couldn't tell the difference between a debate and a fight. I couldn't write. I didn't know what a noun was. So I wasn't prepared like these kids had been prepared. And maybe that's why I'm such a proponent of early childhood education. You get those basic skills or it's very, very hard to catch up. So that's why I went from being an A student in the South Bronx. I thought I would kid to myself, how could I have been so smart in the Bronx and so stupid in Manhattan? And that's why I decided to continue my education by going to schools that accepted you on an audition. But it points out how our educational systems are so disparate, and we haven't closed the education gap like we hoped that we would, which was an original Sesame Street mission.
Absolutely. And the target audience for that show, Sonia, if you can just help us identify
the target audience for Sesame Street in 1969 were underserved African-American children. The idea was if these kids started school with the cognitive skills that their middle-class peers had, they would start school on an even level. And it was through illuminating self-esteem as well, showing a diverse society, which Sesame Street certainly did. We were going to help close the education gap and improve, obviously, the racial dynamics of America. I remember quite clearly, you kind of intimated this, when I was a student at Carnegie Mellon University, and I walked into the student union, and there was a very bald, on the television set, a very bald, very young James Earl Jones reciting the alphabet. I thought, what is this about? This is weird. I thought it was a show about lip reading. You know how he enunciates so deliberately and the letters were flashing over his head. And then the real shocker came when they cut to the street. And as you said, I saw what's my neighborhood doing on television? And then I saw Susan and Gordon. And this was a time when you never saw people of color on television. And if you did, they certainly weren't this beautiful, lovely couple. So that was really shocking. And then I was cast on a show two years later because of activism, because everybody had a platform at that time. Everybody had a political platform at that time. And Mexican-American activists on the West Coast demanded Latino representation on Sesame Street as pronounced as African-American representation on Sesame Street. And that's how Emilio Delgado, who plays Luis, and I got cast. Thank you, thank you, thank you, West Coast activists.
Sonia, what was the audition like for Sesame Street? Did they have you audition with the Muppets, or were you reading the script just on your own?
The audition for Sesame Street was unbelievably simple. This was at a time, and those of you who are in television will understand this idea. This was at a time when one person could make a decision on a television show. There was no committee to address the vision of John Stone, who was one of the major creators of Sesame Street, was all his. And I walked into his office, and I had to do a sorting song or explain the difference between two objects. And it was a trick question because there were two right answers. And I had to tell a story, a scary story, as if he was a four-year-old listener. And I certainly had plenty of scary stories from my childhood to tell. And the audition was half an hour. He said, you don't really have to sing for us because we know you could sing. You're in a Broadway show. Ha ha, I'm glad you didn't ask me to sing. I was a singer in the show Godspell. I was in the original company of that show. And I did sing in that show, but only with the three notes that I could hit. So that's how I succeeded in Godspell. And they didn't ask me to sing on, or John Stone didn't ask me to sing for Sesame Street. Next thing I knew, I was cast. Mm.
And you and Emilio were probably among the first two Latino people that I think you've said some people in the Midwest ever saw on television. Period.
Yes, yes. I find that people have said to me very often, Caucasian people have said to me, you were the first Latinos that we ever knew. And I think it's an interesting statement because I can't imagine that there weren't Latin people around them. But I think that Emilio and I might have been the only two Latinos that they really saw as people. That they really connected with as human beings. So I think that they really did see us as real people, and that's what made the impression on them.
One of the interesting things about Rochester, Maria, is, you know, that dynamic of not knowing each other continues to exist here. And in many communities, you know, Rochester has the fourth highest residential segregation in the country. So we're here, you know, there's women and girls and men of color and white people, but, you know, we're so segregated into certain neighborhoods the same way that I'm sure that you were in the South Bronx. You know, you had neighborhoods then that were also segregated. So even if you might see someone on TV or might not see someone on TV, you know, that developing a relationship across race and ethnicity, it seems like it should be a natural thing. But for many people, it's not. And
well, it's it certainly seems like it should be a natural thing these days. I mean, we started this mission in 69, and I'm you know, heartbroken that we haven't, as a society, developed relationships with people who are different than we are. We are, you know, in a group. And I think a way, as I search for ways of maybe accomplishing that, is a lesson I learned volunteering for a group called the Bronx River Alliance. And there's a Bronx River that the Bronx River connects one of the wealthiest communities in the U.S., Westchester, with the poorest community, the South Bronx, the one I was raised in. So everyone's goal is to clean up the Bronx River. So you could imagine what our get-togethers are like. There's all kinds of people who live up and down the Bronx River. There are wealthy Westchester people, and there are poor people from the South Bronx. But what unites us is that we have a common goal. And I wonder if maybe that's a way of getting people to know each other. Not, you can't like sort of make brunch dates or dinner dates or force people upon each other who don't want to hang out together for whatever reasons. But you can make people see each other if they have a common task, like cleaning up the Bronx River. And also, I find that the more diverse a group is trying to solve a problem, the quicker the solutions come and the better the solutions are, because people from different places will look at one problem with different perspectives in a different way. People who are all the same will look at a problem the same way, and that'll only get you so far. So I wonder if that's a way of attacking this. I always say in my talks, so if you're not going to be at the event on the luncheon, I'll tell you now, if you have a chance to hire someone or work with someone, try to make it someone who doesn't look like you, live in the same neighborhood or make the same amount of money as you. And if they're a different age, that's pretty good too.
I read your blog post about this very issue that you're talking about, and you were saying that maybe the Democratic Party needs a shot of multiculturalism in their veins. Go ahead.
Go on. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, please. You're using this message in a political capacity, and I think you have a lot to say, so please do.
Thank you. I didn't remember saying that, but certainly the Democratic Party could be diverse. And something that David Brooks, the columnist from the New York Times, said on PBS News Hour, he said that that Washington used to be a place where young people wanted to come, and young people would have new ideas for legislation. And it was thrilling for them to come in and try out these new ideas, to come in from the bottom and affect the party from the bottom up. And he said, whereas now, orders are sent down from the top. Both the GOP and the Democrats, the orders are sent down, filtered down from the top, that the people on the bottom should obey and implement. So it's not giving the opportunity for the party to get infused, either party, with new thoughts. Both parties are more interested in getting soldiers to carry out the commands or the desires of people who have been sitting in Congress for very, very long times and might just be out of touch with the people out in the streets, or people who aren't in government.
Yeah, we hear a lot about people living in their own bubbles and landslide mm-hmm. counties. Just looking at some of these statistics about landslide counties, in 1976, 27% of counties were landslide counties. In 2004, 48%. And in 2016, 60%. So many of us are just living and surrounding ourselves with people who think like us and agree with us. We're not exposing ourselves, as you said, to people who think differently, who have different viewpoints.
Right.
And I think that's something that Sesame Street did really well. Going back to the show, we're seeing people of all different ethnicities. We're hearing from people of all different viewpoints. And that's a legacy not only to the show, but also to you, because you wrote a lot of the content that was on the show, correct?
Thank you. Yes, I did. And they were a fabulous group of people who really were interested in my point of view. And one of my mentors, Dulcie Singer, was a producer of the show in the golden years of Sesame Street in the 80s when I was married and had a baby. And, she was instrumental in guiding me. And she actually said to me once, I know what I know. I want to know what you know. And they really wanted my ideas to come across on the show. And also, it was a time where children's television did try to teach cognitive skills, the alphabet, accounting, and so on and so forth. But there was also a lot of room for imagination. Those films were sort of open-ended. I remember I always talk about the film Somebody Come and Play, Somebody Come and Play Today. And it was a gorilla in a cage. This was before zoos were enlightened. And it was a gorilla in a cage looking around, scratching his head while this song played in the background. Well, it just gave me a lot of thoughts. What is the gorilla thinking about? Is he expecting somebody to come and play with him? Am I going to come and play with him? Was another? You know, it was inspiring. You thought of other things. There was a wonderful little film called Navajo Baby, and it was a Navajo woman, probably in the 50s, giving her baby a bath in a basin. And I mean, it just was so fascinating to me. And then there was the film of Appalachia, and there was a man on a donkey delivering mail to a little girl, and you see him walk around the Appalachian Trail. So these weren't films designed, content that wasn't designed to teach you a cognitive skill that you could count or take a test on and pass. It was designed to open up your horizons and make you see the bigger world. And that was exciting. And I knew that that's what the show was getting at. And I said, this is for me. And also they kept saying, I'm backtracking a little bit. I kept saying in the beginning, what should Maria be like? Mm. And they kept saying, because I was an actor and I wasn't Godspell, and it's easier to play a character than it is to just be yourself. And they kept saying, we just want you to be natural. We just want you to be yourself. We don't want any slick, you know, sitcom performing. We don't want you to have slick makeup. We just want you to dress how you dress and be yourself. And I really said, I think I got these people. I get this. They really want me to be myself on purpose. To quote a line from The Color of Money, the movie The Color of Money, be yourself on purpose. And that's what I did.
The amazing thing about having the degree of diversity all in one place is that you do get to see things from a different lens, you know, from a more equitable lens, I think. And that really is so exciting because it stirs people's creativity. You know, like you said, if it was an organization where everybody was the CEO, you know, and all the CEOs get together and they talk about things with each other, it's a whole different product than when you have the person who is sweeping the floors in the room with the CEO. You know, I mean, in terms of, and it seems to me that organizations today are trying to make an effort anyway to flatten out those hierarchies that you said were existing in, you know, in Democratic and Republican parties. And I know that is part of how you get, you know, more engagement and more, you know, creative ideas and more solutions to problems. So it just seems like it's a win for organizations to embrace diversity and inclusion.
Mm-hmm. I think that also a lot of getting back to why kids aren't graduating high school or going to college, and you know, I've even heard parents complain that their children in the third grade hate school, and I'm thinking, what's there to hate in the third grade? But I think we've become such a data-driven society. We just think that kids are vessels that we put all of our ideas into and then expect them to give us back our ideas, and then we've done a good job, where we don't let them bring their ideas to the table. And they do have their own ideas. They will see things differently. I remember once talking to my niece about overpopulation, and that was the theme of the day, overpopulation. And she said, why are you so worried about this? We're going to be living on the stars by then. So, I mean, it was a youthful kind of a positive way of looking at the world, because they always start out looking at the world positively. And, you know, and this was the beginning of Star Wars and all of this kind of stuff. But already her mind was on a different level that I wasn't there. You know, I wasn't of that generation. And I think that kids probably resent being forced to just memorize information. And can you imagine going to a job when all you did was being talked at for 4 hours a day? And you weren't given the opportunity to bring your ideas, and with lack of arts at schools, that's a shame, because that was an outlet for kids. There was also, you know, when I was growing up, I wasn't a great math student, but I was a pretty good artist. And the teacher would kind of say, stick with the arts, Sonia. You know, I could excel in one thing. I didn't have to be the 50% good at sort of everything kid that we expect of children today.
Yeah, we have a program at the YWCA called Parents as Teachers, and that program kind of reinforces those connections in kids' brains. It's working with parents to, you know, I mean, some parents don't know how to play with their kids, you know? I mean, just sit down on the floor with them and start playing, you know, and don't worry about the alphabets. I mean, the alphabets are great, but... You know, there's so much creativity that children need and time to explore and all of that. And what we do is we try to teach the developmental stages for kids so that parents understand, well, you don't need to be there yet. You know, you're still here.
Yes.
in this discovery phase about putting the square block into the square hole.
right. No, you bring up a good point. A lot of cultures are based on or value obedience in children. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, you know, to be obedient was like a nice thing for a girl to be, for a nice Latin girl to be.
Right.
And follow orders and be obedient and don't look at the teacher. Don't look at adults in the eye, because that's a disrespectful. You know, I can't tell you how many teachers said to me, look at me when I'm talking to you. And I said, I can. My mother, you know, I didn't know where to look. I was 10 before I realized you could ask a question. I can't believe this. I didn't know that was something kids did with adults, that you asked a question and you got an answer. And I accidentally asked a teacher a question and he gave me the answer. The world opened up to me. Yeah. But we have to help parents understand that, if they have a smart aleck kid who's always making jokes, that's a sign of intelligence. You don't squash that and say, stop being a smart aleck and don't make jokes. It's hard to make a joke. You know, only smart people make jokes. and parents don't value that in kids. Or, you know, I see it. I see parents with their kids on buses all the time saying, don't sit up on the seat when it's the only way the kid could look out the window. You know, they want the kid to sit as an adult would sit in a seat. And, and I always want to say, look, by the time the kid's taller, it won't sit that way. You know, it'll grow into, you know, it'll do what it, you know, he or she will do what he or she has to do to look out the window. But people think, well, no, I have to immediately start, put the kid in training and make the 6-year-old act like a 10-year-old.
I'm late for our only break of the hour, so we'll take our short break. When we come back, I have many more questions for Sonia and also for Jean, and we'll talk more about the YWCA's Empowering Women Luncheon. And listeners, this is your chance to talk to Sonia Manzano. You can call the show at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI. 263-9994. You can connect with us on Twitter. I'm at MMacMedia. I've had a question come in about Mr. Snuffleupagus that maybe we'll have time to get to later in the hour. And you can also email your questions to connections@wxxi.org. So more connections, more Sonia Manzano next. I'm Megan Mack. Tuesday on The Next Connections, Reconnect Rochester is exploring the connection between poverty and transportation. and it's offering some solutions. It's part of the group's Street Films event on Wednesday. We'll preview that discussion with local leaders. Then in our second hour, Dr. Willie Parker joins us to talk about his book, Life's Work. He's an outspoken Christian abortion provider, and he'll share his story. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, filling in for Evan Dawson today, and we are talking with Sonia Manzano, the actress who played Maria on Sesame Street for 44 years. Also in studio with me is Jean Carroll, the president and CEO of the YWCA of Rochester in Monroe County. And Jean, tell us a little bit more about the event coming up on Wednesday.
Well, we're so excited to have Sonia as our keynote speaker at our luncheon. It's a great event. It's a fundraiser for our programs and services and education that we do at the YWCA. And in addition to Maria, we will have several of the women who have received our services talking about their own individual struggles and how far they have come. So if you want inspiration, the YWCA luncheon is the place to be.
And that is Wednesday. Unfortunately, registration is officially closed. So maybe you have some friends going and they can tell you what it was like, or you can listen to this conversation. You can find it in the podcast later this afternoon at wxxinews.org/connections. I'd like to talk about some powerful moments on Sesame Street, some of those iconic moments where adults like the character of Maria were able to connect really well with kids and the Muppets on the show. It relates to what we were talking about before the break. And one of those moments, at least for me, and I know for a lot of people around the country, is the episode in which Big Bird learns that Mr. Hooper has died. And Sonia, if you can sort of paint a picture for us of what that was like to be part of the cast at that time, because the actor who played Mr. Hooper, Will Lee, did pass away. And that was something the show decided to take on.
Yes, the Goodbye Mr. Hooper episodes were are probably the most talked about when I travel the country today. People want to know about Goodbye Mr. Hooper. And as I mentioned before, my mentor Dulcie Singer, the producer of that time, that was her baby. She got that done. The actor who played Mr. Hooper, Will Lee, passed away. Everyone said, well, we'll just say he retired, or we'll just say anything but that the man had died. And Dulcie insisted that we were known for showing truth in ways that a 4 or 5 year old can understand about life. And death is not a man-made thing. It happens to everyone. It was a process of life, and she wanted to illustrate it. So we have a slew of research people, and they went out there and they looked at everything that was out there for kids about death. Very little, not any books. Fred Rogers had done something about a dying goldfish, but nothing about a human death. And research came back with the concerns that children have when someone who takes care of them is not there anymore. And basically their concerns were, who's going to do for me what this person used to do? And the fact that death was permanent is also something that kids had a hard time understanding.
So we actually have a clip.
No.
From that episode that we can play for the listeners in case they haven't seen it. So let's listen to that scene from, do you know what year that was, Sonia?
Oh, I'm not sure. I want to say it was the late 70s, sometime there. I wasn't a writer at that time. I was, that's how I'm dating it, but I think it was the late 70s.
Okay. And in this scene, Big Bird is handing out pictures or gifts that he's drawn of the different cast members, and in his hand he's holding one of Mr. Hooper, and here's what happens next.
Well, I can't wait till he sees it. Say, where is he? I want to give it to him. I know, he's in the store.
A Big Bird?
Hmm?
He's not in there.
Oh, then where is he?
Big Bird, don't you remember we told you? Mr. Hooper died. He's dead.
Oh, yeah. I remember. Well, I'll give it to him when he comes back.
Big Bird, Mr. Hooper's not coming back.
Why not?
Big Bird, when people die, they don't come back.
Ever?
No, never.
Why not?
Well, Big Bird, they're dead. They can't come back.
Well, he's gonna come back. Why, who's gonna take care of the store? And who's gonna make my birdseed milkshakes and tell me stories?
Big Bird,
I'm gonna take care of the store. Mr. Hooper, he left it to me. And I'll make you your milkshakes and we'll all tell your stories and
sure,
we'll make sure you're okay.
We'll look after you.
Oh. Well, it won't be the same.
Our engineer Rob is tearing up behind the glass.
I know. I am too. We could barely contain our emotions, as you could tell in our voices. And Carol Spinney, who plays Big Bird, could barely contain his emotions and still maintained his persona as Big Bird as he delivered the lines. And Norman Stiles, who wrote the script, he was the head writer at that time, did a brilliant thing at the end of the episode. At the end of the episode, a baby's born. And Big Bird says, "How about that? Mr. Hooper was here, and now he's not, but that baby was never here, and now it is." So it kind of tied it up together in a hopeful note because, you know, we are alive, and therefore we're hopeful.
Mm-hmm. I can't think, well, that's not true. I can think of one other example where a children's television show tackled a concept like death, and I'm sure there are others, but for me, I can only think of one from Fraggle Rock, and maybe this is obscure, but there was an episode, oh gosh, I think it was called Gone But Not Forgotten, where the Fraggle Wembley watches a character die in front of him. It was a character called a Mud Bunny, and I don't know if anyone else is familiar with this episode. I studied children's television in college, so that's why it's so specific. But this Mud Bunny, it's time for him to go back to the clay, and he passes away in front of Wembley the Fraggle, and then Wembley sings this beautiful song about how people are gone, but they're never forgotten. And I thought, watching that, you know, there are 5-year-olds watching this, and they make it so accessible, and it's a terribly sad thing, but what a powerful choice to make,
to take
on a concept like that. And did you, the team at Sesame Street, know the impact that that scene would have at that time? We'd still be talking about it in 2017?
No, I think you can't know at that time. You just follow your instincts and do what you think is right and truthful and hope for the best. But I think that they were onto something when they understood that children don't mind being sad, or they like dramatic things as well as funny things. I remember reading The Little Match Girl when I was a little kid, and I just thought that was such a beautiful story, and it was so sad, and she was going to sell matches or something like that, and then she went to heaven. And, you know, I think parents now will keep stories like that from kids. But it's a beautiful story, and they can... I think when children feel... for a character on television or in a book, it makes them feel stronger and adult, and it's one of the feelings that they will have to manage.
And the show also tackled other difficult issues. There was an episode around 9/11 where Elmo was, I think Maria and Elmo were in Mr. Hooper's store, and there was a fire.
Yes, and there was a fire. Now, that was tricky. That was tricky because you don't know. It was such a horrible event. No one could imagine something like that happening in this country. So they took the components of what might make those things possible or what might scare children. And it was, they saw a lot of firemen. So we explained what firemen did. Then there was a scene about tolerance because obviously that was an act of intolerance, whereas, you know, Big Bird has a friend who doesn't want to play with any humans, only bird friends. Mm. and bullying, there was a bit about bullying and loss. And mm-hmm. so we figured that children were experiencing those four things, those four emotions, and then they put that together in a series for kids. But that was hard. And you don't know what they came away with, what connections they made. We didn't mention any countries or any particular people who may or may not have been responsible, but just the underlying feelings. Mm-hmm. So it was a big thing to take, sort of like the YWCA channel takes on these big issues, race, gender, and poverty.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It was an attempt, yeah.
Sonia, how do you feel, how do you think the media represents either diversity or these tough issues, racism, today? Are we heading in the right direction? Or where do you see opportunities for growth?
I think opportunities are on cable television mm-hmm. for that. I love shows like Atlanta, where is this African American, this young African American community in Atlanta. And I just, you know, it's interesting. There are people that have a different worldview than me because of age and because they're African Americans. And it's really interesting. And so I think that those kinds of shows, that kind of media will thrive more on cable than the network. And obviously, I mean, everybody says this, people of color have to be empowered to green light shows or mm-hmm. create them. Because I think that maybe established shows, they think they want to do a show about people of color, but once they're introduced to something they've never seen before, they can't continue it. So then you end up pandering to what they want to see of people of color, because that's what their perspective is. And they're afraid of presenting something that's not something in their life experience.
Back to those bubbles.
Yeah, yes, yeah, back absolutely. To the bubbles. We go back to the bubbles. That's, you know.
In our last couple minutes, I have a series of rapid-fire questions for you that have come from our listeners, and they all seem pretty fun. So first one up, what's your favorite Muppet, Sonia?
The Oscar the Grouch.
Okay.
Oscar the Grouch, because I can't tell. I could never tell if I was talking to an 8-year-old or a 42-year-old.
Was it tough acting with Muppets?
Yes, because I tried to compete with them in the beginning, and you can't compete with a Muppet any more than you can compete with a child or a pet on television. But once I understood that my job was to be the straight man and they were the comics, smooth sailing.
And what was your favorite episode or moment on the show throughout your 44 years?
I think when Maria gets married and she has her wedding ceremony up on the roof of 123 Sesame Street, mm. That was touching, I thought. And whether they knew it or not, or whether I even realized it or not, when I go through old family pictures of our life in the South Bronx when we lived in tenements, there were a lot of celebrations that took place on rooftops.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So it's all come full circle for you.
It's all come full circle.
When you take a step back and you look at your career, is it overwhelming to think about how many kids you've influenced, how many lives you've impacted?
I don't know. I just put one foot in front of the other. It's best not to think about the overwhelming things that happen to you. It's been wonderful. And people say, you don't know how much the show means to me or you mean to me. And I do know. But still, I've gotten some wonderful notes since my retirement from the show that makes me feel that I've indeed contributed, and that makes me feel wonderful.
And what are you up to next, Sonia? I know your memoir has been out, Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx, which Jean has read and fully recommends. So listeners, check that out.
Absolutely. It's a fantastic
book. Thank you.
Anything else that you're working on that we should be following?
Well, I am still an author with Scholastic, so expect four books from me through them in the future. And I continue to travel the country, giving speeches and answering questions and trying to see people.
And we'll see you in Rochester on Wednesday.
Yes, absolutely. I'm so looking forward to it.
And again, that's the YWCA's Empowering Women Luncheon on Wednesday with Sonia Manzano. And Sonia, you've said in an interview, how could a girl from my background end up on this iconic show? And I have to say, how can a girl from Shalott, New York end up talking to you? So thank you so much. I'm just here from a small town in Rochester. I never thought I'd have the opportunity to talk to you, who influenced my childhood. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we will see you in Rochester. Jean,
absolutely.
Anything you want to add about the luncheon coming up?
No, I'm just I'm thrilled and excited that we have someone of Sonia's stature joining us giving us some inspiration for everyday life.
Awesome.
Well, I'll just share how I see things, and in the hopes that they will see things a little bit like me, but certainly in their own way as well.
Well, let's end with a little humor along with the theme music here. One of our listeners on Twitter had a bit of a silly question, a fun, silly question. He wants to know, where is it? Mr. Snuffleupagus, is he as big of a diva as the media has portrayed him?
He's as big as in anything. Mr. Snuffleupagus is a wonderful, huge character that we thought was imaginary for many years and then came to our senses and really saw him.
Oh, I love it. Thank you. Sonia Manzano, thank you so much for joining us. Jean Carroll from the YWCA, we'll see you on Wednesday at the luncheon.
Yes.
And listeners, thanks for all your questions and comments this hour. We'll leave you with the Sesame Street theme. Thanks so much and have a great afternoon.